Okay, so let's turn our attention now to Matthew chapter 11 on page, Matthew 15 on 111, page 111 is where I got that 11. Kind of hard to pick between Matthew and Mark as far as a basic text for our study this morning. Each of them has material that is unique. And so I'm picking Matthew 15 kind of arbitrarily. I think it typically, maybe just because the first book in your New Testament is easier to remember that these events are in Matthew. But as I say, both Matthew and Mark have complementary material, which is the reason we're studying the harmony. It makes it so valuable and helpful to be able to see the comparison between the two and then weave them together for the full story of what was taking place, which is quite unique and even surprising in a way. At Matthew chapter 15 and verse 21, Jesus went away from there, he was in Capernaum, and withdrew into the district of Tyre and Sidon, and behold, a Canaanite woman came out from that region and began to cry out, saying, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David, my daughter is cruelly demon-possessed." Now, if you have a look at the screen for just a minute here, now what is so unusual about this is Jesus leaving, this is Israel itself up to about this point right here, but leaving this territory, he was sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, and he had made a point, he sent only the lost sheep of the house of Israel, but having made his headquarters up here at Capernaum, just north of the Sea of Galilee, he's now heading into pure Gentile territory. He was sent, I'm going to zoom in to that map in the area you see in the red now. And as we zoom in, he's been staying all this time at Capernaum, and now he's heading off to Tyre and to Sidon, which is not to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. We're specifically told it's a Canaanite woman who comes to make this request of him. So what Jesus has done is he has hiked, as a crow would fly, 34 miles away from the Sea of Galilee out to the coast, there to the almost 45-degree angle north and west. And then, probably along the coast to the next seaport to the north, another 22 miles north. Which is to say, Jesus is an awfully long way away from Israel, from the Jews. And we're not given a lot of insight into why he would do this, say that you'll remember what's been happening in the last couple of days that we've been studying in the biblical history, the last couple of days, what's been happening to Jesus right here on the north shore of the Sea of Galilee.
The disciples have been leaving him.
Okay, the most recent event is a lot of the disciples have left him, and he's made an awful lot of people mad, so the Pharisees are already wanting to kill him, you know, or upset. But immediately before that, on that same day, when he started that day, Jesus was the what in Israel? He was the most popular guy there was, and then he loses those disciples. So there's been a lot going on here, and maybe it is he just needs relief from what may still yet be massive numbers of people who haven't walked away. Maybe there's some danger involved, we're not sure. Maybe, and this is my take on this, but it's just the purest form of speculation, but while during Jesus' life, he is sent only, as the word the scripture uses, it was in Jesus' mouth, only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, after the birth of Christianity in Acts chapter 2, and the gospel begins to be preached, is it only to the Jews? Absolutely not. That's going to figure pretty highly in some subsequent studies here in a little bit, but this maybe is just Jesus' way of saying, hey everybody, I'm sent to the lost sheep of to the house of Israel, that is my mission. When the Holy Spirit comes, these other men are going to be involved, you know, in farther reaches, and Paul will be the apostle to the Gentiles, and born out of season, you know, all those things are true. But perhaps Jesus just wanted everybody to see that he would, in fact, preach and work miracles and interact with Gentiles. So that the Pharisaic sense that you have nothing to do with them, they're filthy, they're defiled, you know, all this that they laid upon those people, more than they should have,
You know, it's just really not true. Jesus then makes this one trip
as a sort of an overture to the Gentiles. Now, in a few minutes, we'll get to some different maps in a moment.
Jesus is also next going to come down into this territory right here.
That is predominantly Gentile territory, though there are a very large number of Jews there and a tribal area there. So we'll talk about that in a little bit.
But at this moment in time, to the northwest and then immediately thereafter to the southeast, Jesus is going to be in
Gentile territory. This is the only exception in the course of his preaching and teaching. That area, by the way, now
is Tyre down here and Sidon, modern day, what's the country?
Lebanon.
I found this particular map, I don't know if I got a date on this one, but this particular map I thought was pretty interesting because the pink and the orange is modern Lebanon today. The pink is identified as do not travel. Okay? So when you listen to your news, you know that Lebanon is a terrifically dangerous country, what we call a dysfunctional state, capital Beirut, and the bombings and terrorism and craziness that goes on there as Muslims fight Muslims back and forth. It's just made it, you know, horrifically dangerous. Times are dangerous for Jesus, too. So whether he's escaping a little bit of that danger at the time, get over here in Tyre and then 22 miles north of Sidon,
we're not sure. But it's an unusual thing, although, if you will note, she has a problem in verse 22 with a daughter who is what? Demon-possessed, and that's bad enough. This one's really bad. She is cruelly demon-possessed. So, remember Mark, if you've been keeping tabs, this is the 10th time in the book of Mark that demons have been mentioned. There'll be a total of 13. Mark makes a special emphasis on Jesus' power over those evil spiritual forces as well. So you want to write the margin there, demons number 10 is what this one is. But Jesus' fame has gone far and wide. So he may have been sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. He spent the great majority of his time with the lost sheep of the house of Israel. But when he shows up in that district of Tyre and Sidon, he is still well known and she is pleading. So in verse 23, he did not answer her a word. We would just call that rude. I believe Jesus is making a point for teaching's sake. He's certainly getting everybody's attention. And his disciples came to him and kept asking him, so apparently they were really pushing this, send her away, for she's shouting out after us. Apparently she's making quite a scene. She will not be denied. She knows she's got her opportunity now. And so, and again, I'm presuming, brethren, what have we learned about demon possession? This is the 10th time.
If a demon possesses you, then how much control do you have? You have virtually none. And we've seen some pretty dramatic instances as well. How much control might other people have over you? We had one that was breaking chains, and nobody could restrain him. And so he, you know, was living out in the tombs and the wilderness and all of that.
And so it's likely that this poor woman, with a daughter that she would love as much as any one of us would, she can't transport her, she can't handle her, and so she's got this one wonderful opportunity. Jesus is in town. She will not just go away, no matter how many times the disciples suggested, and she's shouting after them so that hopefully Jesus will respond, and of course it's going to work, but there it is in verse 24. Jesus has already made this point, now here it is again. I was sent only to the what? Lost sheep of the house of Israel. This is now Jesus' direct declaration that my mission is not to your people. My purpose does not involve you. My particular reason for behaving the way I do doesn't involve you people. But in 25, she came and began to bow down before him, saying, Lord, help me. So apparently, she's making yet another one of her scenes. The disciples are really unhappy about this, maybe trying to elbow a little bit, you know, to keep her away. And Jesus you know, has this conversation now. She's not going away. She bows down before him. Lord, help me. Can imagine the desperation. So in 26, he answered and said, it is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. Brother, no matter, you know, how you read this as just, you know, a common everyday expression that people would use, you know, still, how are you going to read that if you're on the receiving end? That is quite a way of saying that this is inappropriate. And it reflects very directly and very racially upon this individual. Brethren, Matthew says she's a Canaanite. Verse 26 in Mark's column identifies her as Syrophoenician. She is of a group of people who have intermingled with the Syrians farther to the east and the Phoenicians on this northern coast of the eastern side of the Mediterranean. And so, she is about three different ways, you know, Canaanite, Syro, and Phoenician, you know, not a Jew. And they've got an awful lot of animosity between them. And the Jews themselves use this term dog as a common parlance and intended as an insult against these people. So I don't think, brother, we really should even try to soften the blow. Jesus intended to build as high a wall as he could at this moment to say, you are an outsider. You are not the people that I have been sent to. You are asking for something that I have no obligation whatsoever to bestow upon you.
I am amazed at the fact that she knew to ask him, being a Gentile from way afar from where he'd been preaching, that she knew who he was and what he could do for her.
Okay. Let's take it right back to her. If you had a really, really sick child, and Osama bin Laden had the power of miracles, would you ask him?
Probably. But my point was that his notoriety had traveled that far from where he was normally at.
That is correct. That is correct. So you're right. But you see, everything about this, brethren, that's the point. Everything about this is so wrong, it just nobody, you know, would think to do this thing except a mother who is what? Absolutely at her wit's end, desperate. And you'd be that way too. Carol.
And I think the other thing besides the desperation is she is not going to be insulted. Not that she's not just being put off. She listened to what he said, and she's not insulted by it. She listens to it, and she looks for an answer, and she gives him an answer. And because she continued, she was rewarded.
See, amen. And I appreciate somebody breaking the alabaster vial, you know, of oil. And I appreciate tears and wipe the feet, you know, with the hair of your head. But do you really like this woman? Because of the response. This is just such a degree, you know, of respect when Jesus says in 26 again, not going to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs, but she said, yes, Lord, but even, we're turning the page now to 112, left-hand column still is Matthew 15, even the dogs feed on the crumbs which fall from their master's table. So even if you don't varnish this in any way, shape, or form, he just called her a dog. She has said, well, still people are kind of dogs, aren't they? I mean, couldn't you be, you know, helpful to a dog then? And so it's a marvel. Like you say, she doesn't get all huffy and storm off, you know, like she got some deal that pride that she needs to protect. She's got a daughter, and she's going to get through this any way she can for the daughter's sake. And so at 28, Jesus answered and said to her, oh woman, your faith is great. Be it done for you as you wish. And her daughter was healed at once. Now, this comparison, look in the Mark column now, at verse 29. He said to her, "Because of this answer, go your way. The demon has gone out of your daughter." So he's very specific. You get what you want, and I'm going to tell you what it is that you wanted. And going back to her home, she found the child lying on the bed, and what? She's back. The demon is gone. And so this has to be just the most joyful moment, you know, ever for this woman. But it teaches us so much about Jesus as well. Jesus understood his mission. Jesus, as the Son of the living God, though, is preaching the gospel that one day will go to every corner of the entire globe. So it's my personal opinion, nothing specifically says so, but it's my take on it, that he wanted to be on the record here, that he would help these people, but he also wanted to be on the record that what is the all-important thing? What moved Jesus now? What did he elicit from this woman that he cites as the reason why she's going to get what she wants? Faith. She has nothing to offer. She's not buying this thing. Jesus is overcoming his own hurdles. She's overcoming hers. And what, you know, causes him to meet in the middle is faith. Faith is everything. So, O woman, your faith is great. Because of this answer, go your way. The demon is gone from your daughter. Be it done for you as you wish. So off she goes. Now, again, if you'll notice, another thing I love about this harmony so much, but it, with every one of these sections, this bold section headings, this one will be number 113, Healing in Decapolis, but especially immediately under that, between the dashes in italics there, they give you the geographical information. And that is just so helpful. Most Bibles do not provide any geographical information, other than, of course, whatever the Scripture itself would say. So when you notice now in verse 29 of Matthew there, departing from there, Jesus went along by the Sea of Galilee, and having gone up to the mountain, he was sitting there. Does Matthew tell you where he is? It says he's up on a mountain. Last we heard, he was way up in Lebanon somewhere, as we would say. But look at Mark's column. Again, he went out from the region of Tyre, came through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee within the region of what? Decapolis. So, by having them together, Mark has supplied the region. Matthew did not. If you'll have a look at the screen, we'll have our last two little charts right here. But now, this is the Sea of Galilee, so we're looking only at the northern half of Israel itself. Jesus has been in the region of Tyre and Sidon. He's made this long journey, 55 miles, you know, and then however much more for walking. It might be 75 miles on foot. But to zoom in on this area down here now, we have, you know, a very nebulous term, Decapolis. Who can tell me what does Decapolis mean? Ten cities. Thank you very much. So ten cities. Studied her Latin, I guess. Those Roman terms. But good for you, it does. It means ten cities. Deca, of course, being ten. Paulus is city. But, and I realize this map's not real clear, so I'm going to get to another one in just a second here. But this lighter color area, if you can just kind of make it out right there, is what they're calling Decapolis, the region of the ten cities. That is the old, generally, tribal area for Manasseh. There were three tribes that took all or some of their tribal locations when they first came into Israel on the east side of the Jordan River. And so this is the region of Manasseh, a little bit of Gad that might have been involved in that as well. So, but now that, you know, a lot of time has passed, 1,500 years since Joshua conquered the land, those tribal areas exist. Those tribal areas still exist. But Manasseh also had territory on the other side of the Jordan River. They were on both sides. And that being the case, this area is largely also Gentile. It's still, by right, one tribe's area. But they also have this other region they can get into and be more at home, among their own people. So, directly from where there's never been a tribal area and very few Jews, Jesus returns, long journey, probably now he's gone well over 100 miles, and he is down somewhere in this Decapolis region, we know not where. That'll be the last of our charts now, so let's see what takes place there. Since Mark has some additional information, we'll read verse 32 there on page 112 in the right-hand column. They brought to him one who was deaf and spoke with difficulty. So he was able to make some sounds. They entreated him to lay his hand upon him. And he took him aside from the multitude by himself and putting his fingers into his ears. And after spitting, he touched his tongue. And they add in italics, the scripture does not say this, but it says, with the saliva. Well, they're trying to put it together, the translators, the very curious event, 33. You know, so what exactly did he do? He took him aside, put his fingers into the man's ears, and then it says, and after spitting, he touched his tongue. Was it with the saliva? Well, I don't know that I can say. Well, I do know that I can't say. Okay? But also know that this is one of only two times that is very unusual in all the miracles that Jesus did. When Jesus was doing miracles, did he have to make physical contact? Did he make contact with this demon-possessed girl up in Tyre and Sidon? No. Didn't have to do that. When he did make contact, it sounds like it's as simple as just touching the individual and not requiring, you know, any specificity of this is the part of the body, you know, that's hurt, so I'm going to touch that part. But in this case, you know, it's very specific. And then what is the deal with the spitting? Wouldn't you like to know? And I don't know. And so here is an element, and you ask yourself, was that necessary? And couldn't Jesus have healed without it? And, you know, what in the world is the point of that? And what is the definitive answer to all those questions? I don't know. Well, I'll take Carol Shrug. That's the wordless equivalent. Brethren, we have no idea. And so since God doesn't tell us, can we know? Should we know? We need to know. If we did, then what? He would have told us. So, what do we have to do, like it or not, with this particular miracle? To say, okay. Okay. And then let it go. You haven't got anything else to work with. Communicate with the man himself. Okay, well, come on up here. Let me spit. I agree. But I still don't get the spitting part, you know. So I wish I had the answer for you, brother, and I just don't. You're going to see another one a little bit that's, in a way, kind of similar. And so let me point out, this miracle, what makes it particularly unique is not just, you know, the action itself. And I want to dig just a little bit deeper here. And I think rightly so, we always say, the people who are faking miracles today, and that's 100% of anybody who claims miracles today, those people that are pretending to be miracle workers today, frequently, in everybody's presence, without any doubt, absolutely fail. Okay? Now, you and I know they absolutely fail every time. But they do convince some people, and the stories are legion of folks who are emboldened to abandon their crutches and wheelchairs and stuff and are far more seriously injured when they think now they're healed and they try to get back up. You know, you've been looking at that I have for 40 years and, you know, seen just legions of those kinds of stories. But, you know, my point in all of this is we point out
those in Pentecostal charismatic churches today claiming to work miracles, their miracles are nothing like the miracles of the Bible. And we're usually very strong and very forceful because, we'll add, every time in the Bible that anybody who represents God attempts to work a miracle, then they succeed, but they not only succeed, they succeed immediately. Now, I grant, there's only a little bit of time here, but would you necessarily say this is an immediate miracle? Yes and no. What did Jesus have to do with his fingers? Put it in the guy's ears. What did he also have to do? For reasons we don't understand. He also spit, whether it's on his own fingers, whether it's into the ground, whatever he did, you know, we don't know. But you see how that's not instantaneous as instantaneous can be. There's a couple steps involved there. That too is unusual, and we just don't know why. Now, the end result is the same, and I'm not asking anybody to change your terminology. In Scripture, whenever anybody attempts to heal somebody, what's the end result? They are healed. And when I say immediately, I'm getting really technical right here, Jesus never leaves this man's presence and he's healed. In the other one, more time is going to go by than did in this one. But does Jesus ever leave that person's presence either? No. So you can still say immediately, we'll get to it, you can still say immediately, but there are two times where there's this little bit of time that passes. So, just to be aware of that. Now, at verse 33, he took him aside from the multitude by himself, where Mark's called, put his fingers into his ears, after spitting, in what direction or on what, we have no idea, touched his tongue, and, 34, looking up to heaven with a deep sigh, he said to him, Ephphatha. Notice the two diphthongs there, PH. Ephphatha, which means be opened. And his ears were opened, and the impediment of his tongue was removed. And he began speaking plainly. And he gave him orders not to tell anyone. But the more he ordered them, the more widely they continued to proclaim it. And they were utterly astonished, saying, he has done all things well. He makes even the deaf to hear and the dumb to speak. Which suggests to me, I don't have the map up again, but in this area of the Decapolis, to the southeast now of the Sea of Galilee, the old tribal area of Manasseh, doesn't look like Jesus, you know, has been in this region before. Don't believe he goes into this region again. As we were marveling a moment ago, you know, about the notoriety of Jesus in all these different areas, he is very well known, but they do seem kind of surprised, though, in 37. He's utterly astonished. He's done all things well. It makes even the deaf to hear. By this time in the Israel proper, all these things are getting to be very common and well known, and tens of thousands maybe of people have been healed. And so there seems to be an element there, you know, that emphasizes this is the territory that Jesus has not spent much time in. So now back to Matthew's column in the last two verses there on page 112. 30 and 31, great multitudes came to him, bringing with them those who were lame, crippled, blind, and dumb. Many others, they laid them down at his feet, and he healed them. So that the multitude marveled as they saw the dumb speaking, the crippled restored, the lame walking, the blind seeing, they glorified the God of Israel. Back to our comparison with so-called Pentecostal or charismatic attempts to heal today. Is there ever a single failure? No. Is there ever a blank? Well, there is in the Pentecostals. Yes, I said not. You're right. With Jesus, never. With them, always. And so, you know, stark contrast there. Every kind of healing you can imagine. Now, continuing with Matthew, at the top of page 113, Jesus called his disciples to him in verse 32. But notice Mark's addition there in verse 1. In those days when there was a great multitude and they had nothing to eat, he called his disciples and said to them, now back to verse 32, so there's big trouble here, you know, there's nothing to eat, several days have passed, and so he said, I feel compassion for the multitude. They've remained with me now how many days? Three. That's a long time. They have nothing to eat. I do not wish to send them away hungry
lest they faint on the way. So we are now told, thanks to Mark, it's at this same time. And now's the problem. Mark says, in those days. Matthew just says, Jesus called his disciples. Is he in the Decapolis still? Not sure. I would suggest probably. Where had Jesus fed the 5,000 only, you know, a week or two ago? Where, I don't know how long he was in Tyre and Sidon, but recently, in relation to the Sea of Galilee, where did he feed the 5,000? North and a little bit to the west. Where's Decapolis in relation to the Sea of Galilee? South and a little bit to the east. To the north and the west, the immediately bordering territory is Tyre and Sidon, and those old Phoenicians, and you know what we think of as Lebanon. To the south today is Jordan, country of Jordan. Totally Gentiles, predominantly Gentiles. Jesus is working with both. He's healing in both, but now what is he doing in both areas? Now he's doing this feeding of the 5,000. Lost all that popularity in chapter 6, rebuked the people for wanting to have that food, very upset with them. Big event we studied in John chapter 6. And then what's he turn around and do maybe 2 weeks later? Same thing he was just rebuking everybody for. But he's not in the same place, is he? No. So, we can go rapidly over this, though, because it is so very similar. So now let's use Matthew's column. Jesus called his disciples to him. I feel compassion for the multitude. They've remained with me now 3 days. They have nothing to eat. I don't wish to send them away hungry, lest they faint on the way. Disciples said, where would we get so many loaves in a desolate place to satisfy such a great multitude? How long has it been since the last one? 34, Jesus said to them, how many loaves do you have? They said, 7 and a few small fish. And he directed the multitude to sit down on the ground. He took the 7 loaves and the fish. Giving thanks, he broke them and started giving them to the disciples. Disciples in turn to the multitudes. In 37, they all ate and were satisfied, picked up what was left over of the broken pieces. How many baskets? 7. How many extra baskets did they pick up last time? 12. How many did they feed last time? 5,000, verse 38. Those who ate were 4,000 what? Men only. That's what happened with the 5,000 as well. They're not counting the women and the children. And then he sends them away. So he says, no, I don't think we need any comment. He's just repeating this in a more largely Gentile area. So now, verse 39, sending away the multitude, he got into the boat and came to the region of Magadan. Look at the Mark column, and where does it say he went? Dalmanutha. So again, people are eager always, you know, to try to find errors and get on Jesus' case, try to denigrate his authority. What is the word that's immediately preceding Magadan in Matthew's column? Region of Magadan. And then what's the other one? District of Dalmanutha. Okay? Here's these two words. Is there room then to understand that it's not necessarily one tiny little village? In both cases, we're being told he's in the what? Can Dalmanutha be in the region of Magadan and Magadan in the region of Dalmanutha? Well, sure. It's not any kind of contradiction, you know, whatsoever. Is Springfield in the Lane County region, but Eugene is not? People, you know, just are desperate to try to find some kind of contradiction here. In either case, he is on the western shore of the Sea of Galilee, apparently. There's a very famous Mary who was from where? Magdala, and likely this is just a variant spelling of that, which is to say be on the northwest shoulder of the Sea of Galilee. page 114, Matthew's 16 and verse 1. And the Pharisees and Sadducees came up, and what's their attitude? See, they're testing. They're looking for a way. They asked him to show them a sign from heaven. But he answered and said to them, when it is evening, you say, fair weather, for the sky is red. I'm skipping the italicized extra supplied words there. And in the morning, a storm today, for the sky is red and threatening. Do you know how to discern the appearance of the sky, but cannot the signs of the times? An evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and a sign will not be given it except the sign of Jonah. And he left them, and he went away. Now, brethren, you've heard that many times. What do you think Jesus' demeanor was? What was his attitude when he said that? How does he sound to you? Tell me. Sounds mad, doesn't he? Was he? Don't think so. Why don't I think so? Because we have parallel columns. Okay?
So you look over in Mark, and what does Mark say he did?
He sighed deeply in his spirit. Brethren, that does not sound like anger. That's a very odd expression to use for anger. Sighing deeply in your spirit portrays what kind of an attitude? It's disappointment. It's how long? You know, why can't people get these things? And so Jesus, he's had his angry moments. He's cleansed the temple once already, and he's going to do it again. He's had his fight, you know, all throughout John chapter 6 with these Pharisees. He knows. But does he still love them? Sure. Can he still care for them and want to help them and be disappointed in them? Okay? Sure he can. And so, brethren, I've always thought, you know, the picture, let me say, in my mind, is we imagine these events. We read the words, you know, and then we say, he's mad because of what he said. Did he call them evil and adulterous? Well, sure he did. A wicked and adulterous generation seeks a sign, and that they were just asking for the sign. So he does. He does. But is he enraged at this moment because of that? Is he, you know, judgmental because of that? Doesn't seem so. So he says, why does this generation seek for a sign? Truly I say to you, no sign shall be given to this generation. Now, except, and note, Mark doesn't add this, but Matthew alone does, except the sign of what? Sign of Jonah. What is Jonah's sign? 3 days, belly of the whale, see, back again. You'll get your sign, not today. Resurrection's coming. Now then, we'll close off with Matthew still, chapter 16 and verse 5. The disciples came to the other side and had forgotten to take bread. And Jesus said to them, watch out and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees. And they began to discuss among themselves, saying, it's because we took no bread. Which is a way of saying, it sounds like he's going to ask us to go buy some bread and make sure there's no leaven in it. But Jesus, aware of this, said, you men of little faith, why do you discuss among yourselves that you have no bread? What has he done twice? Very recently, both times. Do you not yet understand or remember the 5 loaves of the 5,000 and how many baskets you took up? Or the 7 loaves of the 4,000? How many large baskets you took up? How is it you do not understand that I did not speak to you concerning bread? But beware of the leaven of the Pharisees. Then they understood that he did not say to beware of the leaven of bread, but of the what? The teaching. Now, brethren, whenever somebody teaches, if you're the dough, what is the teacher doing? He's leavening it. He's sprinkling stuff in there. He's influencing you. And for what purpose?
so that you will grow, so that you will change, so that in that learning, you will perfect yourself. But in this case, of course, it's destructive. Leaven associated with the Passover being removed from their homes also conjures the idea of a defilement. Now, I'm going to leap ahead here. I've only got about 2 minutes, but I really do want to hit this in Mark alone on page 115, verses 22 through 26, because we had this earlier again. I'm going to squeeze this in. So they came to Bethsaida. There's at least three of those in the northern area there. Another Bethsaida. They brought a blind man to him and entreated him to touch him. Taking the blind man by the hand, he brought him out of the village. What did he do with the previous guy? Took him apart, away from everybody. And after spitting, this time, what does it specifically say? He spit on his eyes. And laying his hand upon him, he asked him, "Do you see anything?" That's very unusual. He looked up and said, "I see men, for I am seeing them like trees walking about." Was his vision fully corrected instantaneously? No, it wasn't. And this clearly is, you know, an exception. This is different than those previous immediate 100% healings. Then again, he laid his hands upon his eyes, and he looked intently and was restored. The man looked intently and began to see everything clearly. He sent him to his home saying, "Do not even enter the village." No rejoicing. You just go straight home and, you know, take up your life here. So just remember those two events. They take place in the territory predominantly of Gentiles. And Jesus is just back into Israel now in Bethsaida. He would have just stepped over the border from Decapolis. Okay? What does it mean that these two are not 100% immediate and without agency of spit and hand touch it? I do not know. Can it be figured out? Yes, I have the answer to this.
Maybe these things were more common back then for whatever reason. They felt that it had some kind of power or whatever. And maybe it was a method of helping them to believe better that, oh, here's a common thing that we use to fix stuff.
Okay. That's as reasonable as anything I've ever heard.
Okay.
And the operative word is maybe. Take care. That's a great point. It was a bigger commitment and a greater hunger in the second one. Okay, class dismissed. See you in a few minutes.